All right, welcome back, everyone. Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I'm joined by Danny LaRue, as often. And Danny, we're debuting a new feature tomorrow because we tried to debut it today and it didn't really work out. But we'll be doing it soon. We're going to get some more submissions as time goes on.
Yeah, so we want to get listeners' submissions for episode titles. And Nate actually created a hashtag. And what we can do with it now, because part of the problem is we put it out late at night so the East Coasters were already asleep, so we lost a lot of Kristaps Porzingis puns. But,
or we just don't have that many followers. That could also be another explanation. So we tried to put out the solicitations for the title of the episode, and the hashtag is Dunked On Title with no apostrophe, obviously. I'm kind of regretting naming the podcast with an apostrophe. It's kind of confusing, but too late to change now, obviously. It's on cost and all. What did you come up with, Danny?
So the one, my thought, which was inspired by Seth Partnow, was Kristaps Through the Heart. Or Kristaps.
Is that like Bon Jovi,
yes.
Like Shot Through the Heart?
Or you can do Kristaps the Heart, either way, whichever you prefer, because the show has your name on it.
Well, I think this is something that I'm willing to entrust to you, because you are far more willing to suspend disbelief on some of these horrendous puns than I am. The two technicals for Griffin equals door last week was a little bit beyond where I would go, but you know, I think our listeners like
we
that.
All have gifts, Nate.
Well, and unfortunately, here are some of the submissions. Names will be withheld. The Road Warriors, that doesn't really make much sense because the Warriors were at home. A timeout would have been handy, and dumb fouls. Okay, it doesn't quite roll off the tongue. The hungry, the bad, and the ugly. I don't really know what that's supposed to be talking about. So yeah, I guess we'll go with Kristaps Through the Heart tonight.
And
but
assume for when people submit, assume 5 words or less. It can be more, but let's just assume that just to make it, because it needs to be short enough that it'll fit in the episode title.
You know what? No, you could do a 5 tweets in a row that are all one title. I am happy to see that. It's not going to win, but I would be happy to look at that and
maybe
fun of it if it's even that ridiculous.
That's true. But in terms of if you want to win, assume 5 words or less. And in 5 real words, not...
That hashtag, you have to wait for our tweet to listening. Throw it out. Some episodes, usually on a night that I'm live tweeting games, you can assume we'll do an episode that night. Sometimes we're going to record during the day, you know, especially if I have another guest on, and just because it's a little bit fatiguing to record at like midnight every night. But that's what we are here to do for you. So let's start with the subject of tonight's title, Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah, so this was a game that I was actually looking forward to, considering the pretty exciting game they played about a week ago. And the storyline here was, in the whole game, what it was for the last 6/10 of a second last game, and that's Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah, he was fantastic. 10 out of 17 from the field, 29 points. Had 11 rebounds, 2 on the offensive end, a block, plus 20 for the game, perhaps even more impressively, 7 out of 7 from the line. And, you know, I think he just... There wasn't anything that was like such a revelation about this game for me. It's just that he was able to, well, I shouldn't say that it wasn't a revelation, but a lot of it was just him doing what he's been doing so far really well.
Yeah, I that was what I really carried from it, was the variety of his success. This wasn't a game where he was just spotting up and drilling threes or getting tip dunks or whatever. He had a lot of variety in both his attempts and his makes. And that's really encouraging, because when you want somebody to be more integrated in offense, especially as a scorer in some way, you want them to be able to succeed and even to try in a variety of ways.
So here's how he was getting his points. Let me scroll down here. So one thing that I thought was really impressive was his good hands. That his hands were kind of spotty in Europe on pick and rolls, but he was able to make a couple of real nice catches, including one that was kind of down by his waist behind him with his left hand. And then in conjunction with that, he was able to finish with non-dunks around the rim with contact as well. Showed like he was starting to adjust to that a little bit. He made some nice cuts through the lane in the triangle. And then what I was most impressed by with him, and the thing that's really, I think, could make him the type of player that's going to be extremely valuable offensively, is he hit two open threes in pick and pop on ice coverage. And so basically, for to reiterate, and I talked about this actually in my piece with the Cauldron today, of like what icing or blueing or downing is on the pick and roll. Those are not veterans of the podcast. It's basically on a side pick and roll, the ball handler's defender prevents him from getting middle and just funnels him into the big who's kind of waiting in the basket area. Well, with Porzingis, he set the screen and then rolled to the top to the three-point line, and he was able to just shoot a three. I mean, he's 7'3", so he can shoot over basically anyone trying to close out on him. And he hit a couple of those threes, and that's something that he was able to do in Europe. I think we all expected him to be able to do. Even doing that at the power forward position could be valuable against a team that goes with two traditional bigs like Charlotte. But in time, if he's playing center, then it's going to be really, really valuable to be able to do that when you have to change your pick and roll coverage to account for him in the same the way that you do someone like Dirk Nowitzki. That's when you really start opening things up for your teammates to get to the basket, as well as obviously shooting threes instead of long twos.
And one of the kind of considerations in the offensive decision there, when you're deciding what position a guy needs to play, is also the defensive part. And I think in some ways, one of the most encouraging parts of Porzingis' game is that even though he's playing power forward primarily, I think we're seeing some signs that he could eventually handle center defensively.
Yeah, what I want to see, and I haven't seen any team try this against them yet, is what happens when teams go small against him. You know, I can't wait to see them play a team like the Warriors. That's going to be absolutely fascinating to see whether he can hold up defensively in space when he's really challenged that way. Or even a team like, I guess I didn't watch that Wizards game that they played to see how he did there, but, you know, Chris Humphries isn't quite the level of guy that we're talking about here.
My favorite player in the league.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, he can be on your all-aesthetics team. But anyway, yeah, I think just the way they defended tonight, you had a stat that you dug up that they only gave up 83 points per 100 with him in the game per NBA Wowie. They were 1 of 11 on threes in that stretch, not a ton of threes. And so it's really, and they've defended well with him on the court all season, and he has a very positive net rating. And all of those things, that's been the biggest surprise, is his ability to defend and his ability to make an impact on the game physically with his effort. That's been the biggest difference in what he's been able to do versus what I was expecting coming into the year.
And something that we talked about a little bit before that I actually am kind of, it not only makes Porzingis endearing, but I actually think it works, is he's a little bit physically awkward. And that was really apparent on that weird.
He gets more foul calls.
He gets more foul calls that way. It was on that weird spin move, and he had it on the Dream Shake tonight. It was a little bit herky jerky, and people think about that as being, you know, like maybe weird fundamentals or something, but it makes a player off kilter. And the funniest one to me, I actually cracked up watching it, was when he got the first pick and pop three. He took this super awkward step towards the lane, and then on Kaminsky, I believe Kaminsky was guarding him, and then he just kind of slow motioned back to the 3-point line. And I think Kaminsky is just kind of sitting there like, what is this guy doing? And then he was wide open for three and drilled it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that he can do, is just get his shot off. I mean, well, there are a lot more than one thing that he can do, but is get his shot off from deep in a lot of situations. And the fact that he's been able to have as high of a usage rate as he has without really, you know, trying to create one-on-one. I mean, he only had that one post-up look, really, and that's fine. I mean, he doesn't need to be a real good player. He doesn't need to be scoring in that way, even when he's in his prime. I mean, I think of him as, he could ultimately have sort of the same type of effect as like Kevin Love, where he's the combination of his three-point shooting and the offensive rebounding that he's having so far could be a very, I want to say unique, but that's not actually accurate, a rare kind of player. We'll put it that way.
Rare is a good word for it. I like that.
For Charlotte, a quick note. I mean, I didn't watch this whole game. I was mostly focused on Porzingis after the stats he put up. Al Jefferson and Nick Batum, who just destroyed Portland the other night, back to earth, 6 out of 21 tonight. Al Jefferson, I think, is a guy who, much in the way that Pau Gasol is, if he is being defended by a post defender who's not any good, he can just destroy them. But if there are guys who are sound, who are bigger than him, I mean, he's really almost more power forward size, but he just has to play center due to his mobility and the fact that he doesn't have a ton of explosion. Those guys are going to be able to have more of an effect on him, and the Knicks did well against him tonight.
Yeah. Anything else in this game, or do you want to move on?
No, why don't we move on to the Golden State Warriors?
Before that?
Well, no. This is about to be a segue, Danny. How dare you doubt me? Move on to the 12-0 Golden State Warriors. Bill Simmons on his podcast had a great point, which is basically that if this team comes to your town, you have to see them because they are just that good. Steph is that good. They're the best show in the NBA, probably the best show that we've had in maybe even since the Jordan Bulls. I think last year's team was my favorite team to watch since the Jordan Bulls. And if you want to get some tickets to see them in your city, the best way to do that is via the SeatGeek app. SeatGeek aggregates together pretty much every ticket site that is out there, hundreds of ticket sites, and you can be sure then that you are getting the best deal, no stressing out having to go to a bunch of different sites. Also, since it's an app on your phone, you can enable it just with a couple of touches of your finger, no CAPTCHA, no proving that you're not a robot. None of that kind of stuff. It's just very simple. They also have a metric called deal score that shows you how good of a deal it is relative to the other tickets available in that stadium. It's just, frankly, a revolutionary product. We are proud to have them as a sponsor. And if you act now, or actually if you were to act in the future as well, but we'd prefer you act now, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via the code CAPSPACE, which we really want you to use because then they know that you came from us. It supports the program. You get a great deal on tickets. SeatGeek gets to make a little bit of money off it, and everybody wins with SeatGeek and the CAPSPACE code. That is all one word. All right, so let's get to that Warriors game now against the Raptors. It was looking like another Warriors blowout, as has been the pattern of late, where they've gotten up by a lot and have been kind of choking away some of these big leads.
Yeah, I think that, last year there was the story was once they went up 15, the game was over, and there have been a couple of games.
And that has been the case, obviously. They haven't lost any of these games, but they've definitely made themselves sweat a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this game, I don't think the Raptors led after that, but they definitely tied it a couple times.
I think they did actually take the lead.
Oh, you're right, in the fourth, they did.
On the Lowry free throws, right. And then that was actually, I thought, the key possession of the game was when Cal Lowry got fouled, hit a couple of free throws. I think they went up 98-96. And then they tried to trap on the ensuing free throw. And Draymond Green, who's a great ball handler, busted through the trap. And they actually got an alley-oop dunk to Bogut.
That's
on a made free throw, which was not good. And then from that point on, the Warriors, there was either tied or the Warriors led again. That was like 5 minutes to go or something.
Yeah, and you want to throw out that's your stat, right, from NBA Wowie, the one that I thought was really impressive in terms of how you could your best shot at beating this Warriors team.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great shot, but it's also pretty darn obvious, and that is that the Warriors are really, really good after a miss and after a steal. They have an E field goal percentage, basically including the effect of threes in that statistic, of 58.1%. After a miss by the other team, and 73.9% after they get a steal. And it's only 48.8% after a make by the opponent, which is still actually really good. That's basically the league average field goal percentage, and as we know, it's much harder to score after a make by the other team. But the Raptors they put up, I think 67 points in the second half, and did it by getting to the line a ton, 39 free throw attempts in this game. And I asked Luke Walton after the game, how much does that hurt you? And he basically said it happens a lot. Like 39 free throws is a lot. We want to get out and run. We want to get into a rhythm. And free throws let the other team kind of catch their breath, set up their defense. And so that's really one of the biggest games where Golden State has struggled, like going into that Memphis series last year when they got down 2-1. Was when they were fouling too much on Gasol and Randolph. And so that is, getting to the free throw line is, I think, a big key of beating this team.
And the Warriors also have some guys, most notably, though not in this game, Klay Thompson, who sometimes don't really acknowledge the foul trouble they're in, and so they can kind of get themselves in a worse spot. And so if you can get that on a guy, too, then that changes it. And, you know, they have a lot of bigs, but in the smalls in particular, they don't have a ton of depth, especially tonight when Sean Livingston couldn't play.
Yeah, they missed Sean Livingston tonight, and there's some people who don't quite understand what he means to this team. But if you saw this team in 2013-14 when they just got destroyed whenever Steph was off the floor, when they cycled through guys like Steve Blake and Jordan Crawford and Tony Douglas as the backup, and then tonight they had to go with Eden Clark. Livingston is really the only other true point guard on the roster after Steph, and they ultimately just had to go with Andre Iguodala as the point guard, which, you know, he's not really fast enough to do that on a full-time basis. They really need Livingston because he at least, you know, they can really defend with that small unit or with that second unit, even when they are struggling to score. So not having him, he has a strained hip flexor, doesn't sound like anything major. And then Ian Clark really struggled, especially with Corey Joseph pressuring him up a lot.
Yeah, and I think that one of the big stories in this game, and it went in a couple of different facets, is just when teams chose to go small, and when, more importantly in this game, when they chose not to.
Yeah, that's a great point. Casey did not go small at all, really, in the first half, and he saw the lead balloon up to 17 at halftime when he didn't go small with Carroll at the four. He had Scola out there and Valanciunas, and those guys got totally cooked to end the second quarter. And that second quarter, when they actually, the Warriors outscored the Raptors by 13, the Raptors had zero free throw attempts. So they had 39 free throw attempts in the other three quarters, which was massive. And that's why the Raptors, basically outscored the Warriors during the rest of that time.
And something that has been kind of frustrating to me, and I think one of the differences between Luke Walton coaching this team and Steve Kerr coaching it, is that Walton has, though he understands, and he talked about it before the game, he understands the value and the danger, if you want to call it that, of Draymond Green playing center. He's been very reticent to actually use it in moments other than when it was, I guess you could say, obvious. And one of the effects of Dwayne Casey deciding to intentionally foul Andrew Bogut is that eventually, after a couple of intentional fouls, that got him out of the game, which actually leads the Warriors to what I think is their best five-man lineup.
Yeah, now, there are a couple of aspects to this. One is that Draymond Green was sick. He ended up playing his usual minutes, but maybe they didn't want to play him at center for that reason. But I think more likely is just because it was Valanciunas in there, who had a terrible game, by the way, for the Raptors. Wasn't able to get anything going in the post at all, and was getting cooked pretty badly defensively. And so I think Walton has closed with that lineup before, has gone with it more, but against Brook Lopez as well, he didn't want to go there. And I feel like they just have the advantage against those big centers. And they're so quick double-teaming if they absolutely have to. But, make him prove that you can score in the post against that small lineup against Draymond Green or see what happens. And what did happen is that as soon as Walton went with that small lineup because they were fouling Bogut, Casey downsized and went with Scola at center, and from that point on, the Warriors actually took control of the game. So it was and got some really good shots, even though they had a couple of bad turnovers. But the defense was much better as well. Green was much better defending the basket against the drives of Lowry and DeRozan right at the basket, even though he's 6'6". He was able to just, a lot of times it's more lateral mobility and getting your chest in front of guys, and also his great wingspan and timing, than it is, just being big. And so he was actually more effective than Bogut or Azili defending the rim in his minutes as the center.
Yeah, and it also, him playing there, I don't know if you want to go here right now, but I think it's a good time to lead into it, to one of the more curious parts of this game, which was the last offensive possession for the Raptors.
Well, yeah, I guess we should go through the whole thing. And this is an ugly game down the end. I mean, I think we'll get to that last possession.
Okay.
It was an ugly game down the end. I mean, down the stretch, there were like three fouls on going for offensive rebounds in the penalty that just gave immediate free throws. That is a very underrated play that doesn't really show up on the stat sheet. But when you basically are giving the other team, especially if you're ahead, the chance to shoot free throws immediately without even bringing the ball over half court because you commit a loose ball foul. That's really terrible. They also had the offensive foul by Lowry, which I'm sure a lot of Toronto fans were really aggrieved at. What they were trying to do was set, you know, a 2-1 pick and roll and get Steph Curry onto DeRozan. And so the Warriors ended up switching that a little bit. But two possessions in a row, essentially, Lowry set just Mack truck, you know, offensive lineman blocking downfield on a screen pass type of picks. And the second time, the refs, I think, just tired of it and got him with the call. And that was the only possession that Toronto had where they were under 2 points with a chance to tie.
Yeah.
But then, obviously, that last possession was pretty ugly, too.
Do you want to talk about Klay first, or do you want to talk about the last possession first?
No, go ahead.
So Klay Thompson had a great first half. I believe he had 18 points. He was hitting open shots. He was passing. He was doing a nice job. And then in the second half, he just disappeared offensively. He was 0 of 6 from the field, missed all of his threes. And not only that, but yeah, he had some defensive moments, and I believe he had a nice lob in the second half, but he had no rebounds and 2 fouls. So he's a guy who it's always a challenge in terms of the stat sheet. Obviously, he does things that are not on the stat sheet in terms of value. But when Draymond Green was dealing with sickness and Klay wasn't himself in the second half, I think that really tightened the margin that the Warriors needed and was a big part of the reason that the Raptors were able to come back.
Yeah, and Klay got most of his points in that first half in transition, getting the threes, attacking a scrambled defense. Once the Raptors were getting to the line so much, those transition opportunities really dried up for him quite a bit. So that was a concern. Then the last possession of the game for the Raptors was just head-scratching. The Warriors actually forced Toronto to burn their last time out with about a minute 40 left by denying an inbounds pass after a preceding timeout. And then, so the Raptors didn't have any timeouts left. But after two Warriors free throws put them up by three, there are about 10 seconds left, and Lowry dribbles down and goes for the quick two, not even having any timeouts. So, I mean, if you score with six, and of course it was quick, but it wasn't a two because Draymond Green just blocked his layup, so it wasn't even like he had some amazing lane to the basket. And then there were 6 seconds left at that point. You know, even if you score, now, Golden State could take a timeout, advance the ball, so you're not really going to be able to press. And then they're going to score again, and you're going to have to. They've got Steph Curry on the team, so they're going to get another two free throws, or Klay Thompson, very likely. So now you're going to be down three again coming back, and you have no timeouts. So,
and you have to take it all the way across the court, so you can probably if the Warriors have the chance, they could probably foul in the half court even, and then just basically that ends the game.
Yeah, that's true. You could just foul in the backcourt if you're the Warriors as well. That's another great point there. So I don't know. That was not really a smart play. I mean, I think that's something that should have been communicated to him by the bench. And the Raptors, I don't want to take away from the fact that they played really well in this game. I want to get to that. But they also had some miscommunications down the stretch. There are 2 or 3 times down the end where Corey Joseph apparently didn't know where to go, because what they were trying to do was have Corey set some screens for DeRozan, who had Iguodala on him, and then so DeRozan would be able to get Klay or Steph on him, and he was actually really killing Klay. But Joseph kept screwing that up, and you know, there were a couple of possessions where they weren't really able to get into it until about 10 left on the shot clock because they had to yell at Corey Joseph where to go. So that was surprising to me. You know, he has a reputation as a relatively heady player because he played in San Antonio. Obviously, he must be heady, right? But anyway, so that was surprising. But what did you think of DeRozan's game? I thought he was, despite the fact that I'm not in love with his game aesthetically, I thought he was incredibly effective.
Yeah, I think the first half was a little bit more of the DeRozan that you and I can get frustrated with, but he had some really, not only some really nice drives, but he had some passing that showed vision too. And he's a guy, there are players like this in the league, and sometimes it can frustrate me because you can tell they have good vision and they're good passers, they just don't do it very often. But he had some beautiful drives in the second half of this game, and you know, he had some moments where he kind of put their offense on his back, and against a Warriors team that is generally the best defensive team in the league. He was getting to the line a lot, and he was dictating the game, and that's something that not many guys can do.
Yeah, he had 28 points on... I mean, he wasn't actually that efficient, ultimately, but the fact that he was able to get to the line for 13 free throw attempts and have 6 assists was very encouraging. He was really was scoring over guys at the rim quite a bit, whether it was Bogut or Azili. He was hitting the mid-range jumper over Clay. This was another guy where Clay really seems to struggle against these guys who like to shoot mid-rangers because he just doesn't quite have the athleticism or the strength to make them uncomfortable. And I know he played a lot of one-on-one defensively, I think, to try and kind of fix that problem over the offseason, but he looks like he still has a little bit of a way to go on that. I will say one thing to you, though. I do not think the Warriors have the best defense in the league. I actually am a little worried about their defense, giving up the amount of points that they did to the Raptors in this game, the amount of points that they did to the Wolves. I think the offense is better, in large part due to Curry and Green, but I don't think the defense is at the same level as it was last year.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. I think that, you know, I think they'll have to get into it, and the injuries that they've had haven't really helped just because they haven't had true continuity there. But yeah, I think that that is definitely something that I've thought about, and especially in the second half, like the Raptors were doing a much better job of getting what they wanted, and I think that's a big part of what good defenses do is preventing a team from doing that. And, you know, maybe they're going to make other shots, and you know, you are going to have games like that first quarter against the Nets where the team is just making every shot, but you have to make them work for it. And yeah, you're right. They've been outscoring teams more than last year, but at the same time, I mean, it is still early, and I think that a big test for them, depending on who plays for the Clippers, will be on Thursday.
Yeah, I guess if Paul's not back, then it may not be quite the test that we're talking about. You know who else was awesome in this game, by the way, for the Raptors? And it got into a little bit of a Twitter discussion here where someone pointed out that Jamari Carroll is shooting 35% after I said he's worth every penny. Well, they've played really well when he's been in the lineup. And he still didn't look like he had quite his usual bounce. You know, I don't know how much that plantar fasciitis is affecting him, but he had 17 points in this game on 12 shooting possessions, 6 steals. He was just fantastic on the backside of the Warriors' pick and rolls. He was able to help effectively off of Klay Thompson a fair amount, especially in the second half. 3 out of 6 on threes. This guy has been exactly what they needed. And granted, at his age, you know, 32 years old, the last year of that contract might be ugly. But for right now, I think he's earning every penny of that contract.
And what's so nice about him, they didn't use it a ton today, is that since he can bounce between the forward positions, as you're a Raptors team that actually has a little bit more in play than people think, though the Ross contract did change it a little bit and he's out right now, that he can bounce between the 3 and the 4, I think is something that could be a huge asset for them, not only now, but in the playoffs.
I think that's right. And I thought Casey should have gone to that lineup more. I thought that when he did go with that in the fourth quarter, it was pretty effective. Now, I think they're missing a wing in Ross, and that maybe once he gets back and if he can start playing effectively, I mean, because they really only have, I think, 4 wings, you know, 4 smalls that they trust with Carroll, Joseph, Lowry, and DeRozan that he wants to have out there. And so you're limited in the amount that you can play small for that reason. You know, James Johnson really is kind of more of a power forward as well, and they still kind of lack for the shooting. So I think Ross, if he can get out there against a lot of teams and actually start hitting some shots and not be awful defensively, could unlock more of those lineups potentially. Yeah. Steph Curry, by the way, 13 out of 23, 5 out of 10 on threes, 37 points. The one thing I did note, though, he basically had no free throw attempts until the end. He had 1 free throw. And I think we need to find a way in sort of describing player value to discount a little bit those free throws. I mean, those are critically important to winning the game, but it's not like you're doing anything to get those free throw attempts. And so you say, oh, this guy's a high free throw attempt rate. You know, a lot of Steph's free throws, and not to single him out, there's plenty of other guys that are in this boat, are just from must-foul intentional situations like the Raptors were in late. So that's just something I think to consider, is that a lot of guys, especially point guards or two guards, get their free throw attempts inflated due to those intentional fouling at the end, and maybe people who come up with player evaluations need to consider that slightly more than they do.
Yeah, and
also seven turnovers for
seven turnovers. One thing that is partially credited to Curry and a lot of other guys is that the Warriors made 43 shots and they had assists on 31 of them, so that's more than 70%, which is awfully impressive.
Yes, it is. All right, let's talk some of these other games here.
Want to go Wolves?
Yeah, let's go Wolves. So Ricky Rubio was back, and my initial hypothesis was, oh, hey, he's back. Now they won, right? And I thought he played well. They need him, certainly. But Zach Lavin, is that how you pronounce his name? Levine, that's right. Yeah, it's Zach Lavin. Yeah.
You got it right the first time. I'm so impressed.
He was actually had some moments, especially at the beginning of the fourth quarter when the Wolves started their comeback against a Heat second unit that had been lights out until tonight.
So, yeah, you watched a lot more of this than I did. What did you think it was different on the second unit today than it was, let's say, a week ago when they were really humming?
Oh, for the Heat, you mean? Well, Tyler Johnson came back to earth. He had had some really good games, especially against Utah when he had 17 points. He was one out of six today. Winslow had played 31 minutes. He had six turnovers, which is pretty ugly. Couldn't hit a free throw either. So that didn't help much. The other thing that didn't help, although this wasn't related to the second unit, is that Dwayne Wade continuing his troubling pattern of when he goes up against good shooting guard defenders, which Andrew, and especially guys who can overwhelm him physically like Paul George or Andrew Wiggins tonight, tries to do too much and takes some bad shots, especially down the stretch. He was 5 out of 13, 0 free throw attempts, 5 turnovers today. That was not good. Really, nobody on the Heat had a good offensive game other than maybe Whiteside, but even he was 2 for 9 from the foul line and had to get taken off late, and that was when the Wolves went on an 8-0 run to really take control was partially when he was out of the game.
Yeah, and Whiteside, though, had one hell of a game.
Yeah, by the way, for everyone who says, and he did, yeah, I mean, he had a triple-double, including blocks. But also, you know, I mean, Karl Towns had a nice game as well, despite the fact that Whiteside blocked him a few times. What was I going to say about Whiteside? The intentional fouling, like yeah. Bogut, Whiteside. Yeah, guess what? It's not two people anymore, as Kevin Pelton would tell you, and hopefully we'll tell you on this podcast pretty soon. But it's getting to be a problem. There's no reason that this should continue, and this is basically, it's moralizing, essentially, to say that we should continue the rules to allow intentional fouling. There's no other basketball league in the world that I'm aware of that allows this at any level to just intentionally foul guys. So it's not like this is some huge tradition-changing thing to outlaw it. We do outlaw it in the last 2 minutes of the game, and the reason they do that is because you don't want it to mess up the game. So why is it okay to mess up the game earlier on? I really just don't get it. And finally, it's just like nobody wants to see it. There are basketball purists who think it's going to hurt. I mean, all the arguments are stupid, but it just boils down to, like, I don't want to watch it. It's boring. It sucks. It stops games. Like, it's not basketball.
And if they can do it at the same time that they can figure out a way to punish the Euro foul, I'm all for that, too.
Yeah, and I used to be on the side of actually, all right, you know, you should be able to make your free throws. There should sort of be a balance for just putting this big, unskilled oaf out there. But ultimately, it matters what the result is on the court and what the product looks like, more than sort of these more nebulous ideas of moralizing or how the way the world should be or whatever it is. The fact is, guys are just going to continue to get intentionally fouled, and it's going to be ugly, and it's not good for the league.
And teams can still use unintentional, intentional fouls in certain ways, you know. So, like, basically you could make it so that DeAndre Jordan can't really be involved in the action of an offensive play because then you can foul him. And so that can change a team strategy. So they are.
Yeah, but the thing that about that, though, is then the guy who's guarding him, another big, is the one who has to commit the foul. You can't just put guys in solely for the purpose of fouling. You know, you're not going to be able to get the foul often enough. the guys that you actually need are going to get into foul trouble. So that could really obviate that strategy quite a bit.
But at least, you know, like there would be some slight outlets. I'm just trying to basically give those people an olive branch so that they're not complaining incessantly.
All right. I had a few more notes on this game and as the Wolves took control. Towns had 5 offensive rebounds. He also was able to make hay because they were setting some nice flex down screens for him, basically coming up from the block to the elbow area. And most centers are going to have zero chance of guarding those sorts of plays. And he has the footwork and the quickness to get into position and drain those shots. And especially if he's doing that to get a 3. I mean, Whiteside is never a guy who's going to leave the paint. And then ultimately, he even had to come out high enough that Zach LaVine was able to get to the basket. Wiggins was able to get to the basket a couple of times. So Towns, another fantastic game. He also had some fantastic closeouts late on Chris Bosh at the three-point line. Once they took Whiteside out of the game and were playing Bosh at center, he continues to defend really well. They shut down Miami, only giving up 89 points in this game. And Rubio being back helped a lot, too. So that's one observation. The other one is that Wiggins, although he got his shot blocked a bunch by Whiteside early, continued to go right at the basket. The whole thing about him not being aggressive, I've never bought that. I thought that he just didn't necessarily have the skill level to actually, you know, go by guys and make guys miss and get to the basket. But he's getting there now, and he's able to do some nice Euro stuff. So he had one where he just, like, split McRoberts and Whiteside and scored. That was fantastic. He almost ended Whiteside's life by dunking over him, but he missed it. So he had a really nice game, very encouraging game. Even though he was only 8 for 21, he got to the line enough to make it an efficient night. The concern, though, is that Rubio may not still be healthy, and he didn't look it in this game.
Yeah, and I mean, the crazy thing about their rotation is that even an unhealthy Rubio is still better than their just options because it slides everybody else down. But the idea is to get him right eventually. And so, yeah, it's definitely a concern because he's such an important part of their success that I don't think you want to rush it to kind of keep them a little bit above board and just lower their just keep on delaying them reaching not their full ceiling, but, you know, their relative ceiling right now.
Yeah. I mean, he's had a sore knee. He wasn't supposed to be out this long, so it clearly wasn't responding the way I think they liked, but they went on this losing streak. He told beat writer Jerry Zagoda after the game, "I'm not 100%, but I need to be out there helping my team." But he looked like he was going half speed on offense all game. He was still able to be effective because he was so smart. I mean, the play that stuck out to me was he dug down and got a nice steal on a drop-off pass. And then on a play where he would normally break out on the fast break, he's basically jogging down at half speed and actually still was able to make a nice pass ultimately. I think to Wiggins for a 3, but he just did not look right. And being out there like that, going at that kind of speed, I mean, I think with a sore knee, you have to assume that that's going to continue as long as he's out there until he gets some rest. So, yeah, it's worrisome because they obviously, you know, they can't win without him playing a lot of times, even though Zach LaVine did play well tonight.
One stat I wanted to throw out is that per NBA stat tracking, the Wolves were 3 of 14 at the rim when Hassan Whiteside was the closest defender, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, they did get fouled a fair amount of times. Some of those were his fouls. Some of them were fouls by others who were in the area. So that's a little bit misleading. But, yeah, pretty remarkable. And, you know, I think almost all of those were blocked shots by him. It wasn't just forcing a miss.
Anything else you have on this one?
No, that is all. So tell us about, like, what Wiggins' stat line was like.
So he had a very weird shot chart in that he took 21 shots, which is a lot, and only one of them was a 3. And so he was 4 of 8 on 2s outside of the paint. He was 1 of 5 in the restricted area, which is Hassan Whiteside, and then he was 8 of 11 from the line. So you kind of piece that together, and so he had an all right night. He just did it in a very unconventional way.
All right, you ready to move on to Atlanta-Brooklyn, and then we'll do Cleveland-Detroit, and then we're done.
Sure.
So I watched the fourth quarter of this game, but a few notes from before then. The Hawks did not have Jeff Teague or Kent Bazemore returned an ankle. in the last game they played against Utah. So they actually started Paul Millsap at the three. Tiago Splitter still only played 12 minutes in this game. So I guess it was not Coach Bud decided that that was not a particularly effective alignment. And I agree. I don't think Millsap is good enough at the three. I think like playing a lot of fours, when you move them down to the three, you take away what makes them so good. Either it's usually it is their shooting ability and their quickness while still being able to defend and rebound for that position. And so when you put him at the three, you're not going to have enough spacing on the floor with Splitter out there as well to really post him up and take advantage there. So I don't think that that lineup ultimately is going to work that well, even though I think it did okay by plus minus today. I still don't think it's all that great. The Nets, though, got some good shooting from their point guards. That was really important. Shane Larkin was 4 of 6 on threes. I think Jack was 3 out of 5. Jack taking some above-the-break threes, which he, in his career, has been kind of loath to take, and he's been taking more of them lately. I think that just, you know, we talked about how the Nets don't have that much pick-and-roll playmaking, and that's a big problem for them when we were sort of discussing whether their fan base should panic or not. But if they can at least get competent three-point shooting from those guys, and even Larkin, some of his were off the pick and roll, that opens things up a lot. Then ISO Joe can get his game going. He had 9 assists in this game. A lot of them actually were to the point guards for three-point shots. I watched all his assists. And the Nets now have been pretty solid in their last 4 games. They beat Houston. They lost a close one to the Kings. They lost a close one to the Warriors. And now they beat the Hawks at home. So maybe we can expect now, after that initially terrible run, that this team can at least be back to respectability for the time being.
Yeah, it's definitely encouraging. I mean, we saw that when we saw them last week. And what did you think about Horford in this game?
8 for 11, which was excellent. Another 2 for 3 on threes, a couple of them above the break. So that really is just, that's really just going to help the Hawks offense a lot. Part of the problem is that Schroeder is not quite the passer that Teague is. And with Teague out, they weren't able to get quite as many shots for Horford as you might have hoped. By running pick and pop in the playoffs last year, they were able to get whatever they wanted with Al Horford running pick and pop guarded by Brook Lopez down the stretch. They did have a couple of possessions where they ran that. On one of them, Horford was able to get open, and then on the other one, Lopez was not able to help, and then they set up a corner three for Tabo. That was the last lead that the Hawks had in that game, 88-86. And then the Nets were able to come back down after that. They went no timeout. Jack was really smart, got a nice mid-range jump shot, which ordinarily not the greatest shot, but he was open. He got a screen in transition, and most importantly, he got the 2-for-1, which proved absolutely critical given what happened at the end of the game. Then Brook Lopez played great D on their last possession when they tried to run that Horford pick and pop again. Lopez actually was able to shut it down twice, get back to Horford, be on the axis, prevent the pass to him. Schroeder essentially was trapped in the corner, had to give it up, and the Hawks forced a shot. Millsap got the offensive rebound, got blocked by Lopez. There were about 5 seconds left, and the Nets, rather than calling timeout, everybody was on it. They were ready to go. There was no looking towards the bench. They all just sprinted back. They beat the Hawks down the floor, and Thad Young was able to get a layup, and he got undercut pretty dangerously by Kyle Korver, and was down for a while, hit 2 free throws, and then Young also was able to knock away the inbounds pass after they did a nice job switching. So it was really excellent, excellent execution by the Nets in the last 40 seconds of the game, making up for what had been horrendous execution by them on Saturday against the Warriors.
Yeah, and the other thing I want to mention is, I thought we saw it live when we were watching it, was that Lopez did an awesome job on that final inbound.
Yeah, that's true too. They put him on the ball, and he was very active and obscured the vision of the inbound passer, Cephalosha. So yeah, you know, Brooklyn is looking a little bit better. Thad Young is having a very nice season. He's a good player who I think is underrated. Their whole season turned around when he got there last year, and starting him at the four, he's a pretty effective player. And I think when you consider that he's only, I think, 27. He's been, even despite being around forever, he was in that 2007 draft, I think, but he came out after being a freshman. Getting him for $12 million a year, at least for the time being, with the fact that he's been a quality starter for them, is actually shockingly a pretty decent deal for the Nets, especially when you consider that it was low enough that they're going to be able to avoid the tax this season.
Yeah, it's huge for that. And also, he's at a really good level because if they, you know, if the right person comes along, we both think it might be unlikely, and wants to go there, then he's at a number now where somebody else will be interested in it. So it's a good, so you can keep him, you can be happy with it, or if the right thing comes along, you can move him easily.
Yeah, or you even maybe, if they decide that they are kind of, you know, in really rebuilding mode as well, he could be traded even for like a first round pick or something for a power forward needy team. And I think like he also might be a good fit as a guy coming off the bench for like a team like Utah, actually. I think he would be an excellent fit with them because they have two guys who start in Favors and Gobert who could shift over to the five, and Young could come in off the bench and play with either of them as a four. That's getting ahead of ourselves, but it's I think his contract is looking like an asset so far.
Yep.
So, yeah, go ahead.
No, that's, I was going to lead into Cleveland.
Okay.
So this game was it was close the whole way down.
Yeah, we watched the end of this one together at the arena.
We did. And I think a lot of this to me was about Cleveland executing on defense.
Yeah, they definitely had a few times where they didn't do what they're doing involving J.R. Smith down the stretch. The first one of those was a pick and pop where that got iced and sent to the baseline, and then Ilyasova popped out to the three-point line, and what happened was that Love picked up the ball handler. He did a nice job, and then Smith was torn between either running back to Ilyasova on a switch or thinking that LeBron was coming over to get Ilyasova, and so he actually started running towards LeBron's man, and LeBron didn't, and so they ended up kind of yelling at each other. I don't know what the scheme implies there, even if there is something that you're supposed to do, but they did not succeed in communicating there in what is a very difficult situation to do so. So that ended up being a three for Detroit because Cleveland was up and Detroit actually was able to get back into it. And then on another play, that Jackson Drummond pick and roll, JR was on the near side wing, and it was like KCP or someone, I think, that he was guarding. And Mozgov actually pointed to Reggie Jackson because Mozgov, I think the way they were playing it was his job was to get back to Drummond to prevent the alley-oop. And then because Jackson had gotten around the point guard, Smith was supposed to kind of stunt at him and stop him. You could see Mozgov pointing to him. LeBron then was on the backside. He did not get in the way of Drummond. They got an alley-oop. And then LeBron was yelling at Smith again. So you never know what the scheme is supposed to be, but that was my best guess at it. And so due to those two Smith errors, they gave up five critical points. Despite that, they're up by four with 3 minutes left. And then they decided to go to Hack a Drummond, and he actually made three out of four.
Which is a really nice development, both for him and for the league, because we're just so blanking sick of that.
Oh, yeah, so I guess that's the third guy who was intentionally fouled today.
Yeah, it was at least three. It might have even been four.
Who's the fourth?
I'm just thinking. I think Kevin Pelton would be able to know. We can talk. We'll ask him.
So Cleveland was up 97-93. They basically let Detroit back into it with the fouling. But we were critical, or I was on Twitter, of, oh, it's just boring, you know, 1-3 pick and roll to LeBron, get the point guard on him, back down, try and score. But that was actually very simplistic because as I went back and looked, they were running a lot of nice stuff. And for Kevin Love, like they had Love coming off a down screen for a three at the top of the key. He airballed it. They had Love get a back screen from the corner, going to the basket. Great pass from LeBron. Drummond comes over. Love throws the pass to Mozgov away. LeBron got the switch on the 1-3 pick and roll, starts backing down. Threw it to the corner to Love. Love didn't quite have his feet set, missed the three. So they had plenty of chances where they were moving the ball around, and then LeBron at another time drove down the lane, hit Mozgov for an open baseline J that rattled in and out, you know, but still maybe not the greatest shot. So LeBron actually played very unselfishly. They were moving the ball around, actually really running some stuff, and it was just the two possessions that we saw were sort of boring attempts for him to back down. One of them, he missed a floater over Jackson, who did a decent job on him considering that he's a point guard. And then the other time, they sort of collapsed on LeBron, and then he tried to throw it back to Mo Williams at the top, and I don't know, he just threw it away, and it was a backcourt violation where they didn't know, you didn't know where Mo was going to be exactly. So the Cavs did. I mean, I think the process was good for them. Love is someone a little bit of a concern because he has historically been a very poor clutch player, and his Minnesota teams the last couple of years fared very poorly in the clutch. That was also Kevin Martin's another guy who is historically very bad in the clutch that was on those teams. So, yeah, that's something to monitor, is what that Cavs crunch time offense is going to look like. And a nice win for Detroit coming back. They, especially having finished up in L.A. on Sunday, flying back and then playing again Tuesday against the Cavs. Impressive win for them, and they played some good defense on the stretch.
Yeah, and got some clutch free throws from Reggie Jackson, who's a guy who it feels like he does that whenever he's put at the line.
Yeah, that's true. He had some clutch free throws back in that Oklahoma City Clippers series, as I recall, and I think he was 6 out of 6 on clutch free throws in this game. The Cavs actually do deserve some credit. They went for the quick two, which I don't mind as much with LeBron because he can be counted on to make the right decision and throw it out, and you know, he shoots like 75% in the restricted area or whatever it is over his career, so the quick two is actually going to be two for him a lot of times. But then they actually tried to trap, and they had Reggie Jackson. I mean, there's really no NBA team that has like a real designated press breaker. They just kind of throw it in and just figure these are NBA players. They're not going to screw up. It's just not worth spending the practice time on with all the other stuff that you have to deal with that has a greater application. And I thought they actually got a strip on Reggie. He sort of like went up off 1 foot, like way in the backcourt to try and throw it ahead, and they bailed him out with a foul call. But he hit his free throws, and then J.R. Smith missed a pretty good look at a three that could have tied it, and that was about it for the game.
Yeah, and the only other thing I wanted to add was LeBron. It felt like a kind of a current LeBron in the first two parts of this, except the third. So he was 6 of 8 in the restricted area, which is, you know, it's pretty close to LeBron. Then he was 1 of 6 on twos outside of the restricted area, but then the part that was different is he was 4 of 7 on threes, and all but one of those were above the break.
Yeah, and he's been hitting pretty well from three-point range these last couple of games, so maybe he's turned the corner a little bit with his jump shot, but we'll keep an eye on that still. I'm not convinced that just because of two good games from three, he's out of the woods there yet.
So a little bit of news and notes, and then we'll head out?
Yes. What do we got?
Well, Anthony Davis.
Yeah. You know, we may be getting some nice, like, Twitter matchups of a Pelican and a Tank pretty soon because he injured his shoulder. He was unable to finish the game. They got smashed at home by 18 to the Nuggets, who pulled away in the second half. Had, as you might expect, they had absolutely nobody to guard Danilo Gallinari. I mean, Luke Babbitt was on him much of the game. That's never going to end well. Gallo, I think, had 27 points. And, I mean, this is not a good Denver offense. Giving up a buck 15 to them, totally unacceptable. And, you know, whether you got AD in the game or not, it did not look like anything too bad. It looked like Moutier just went through a screen of his and, you know, kind of ran into his shoulder and tweaked it. But he's had shoulder injuries before, but he's had like, you know, 12 or 13 different injuries so far in his career. And this is only his fourth year, all of them kind of smaller nagging things. But, you know, I mean, this is why another reason why it didn't look like he was going to be the MVP, because, you know, he plays 65 games a year. And if he's going to miss time now, they are now, what, 1-10?
I think so.
They have a real hard schedule coming up. I mean, I think you're getting almost to the point now where you just have to talk about this team trying to tank, which actually ultimately might be the best thing long-term for this team.
It really might be, because we have talked before about the way that they've spent their money. They don't have as much flexibility as one might think, especially if, well, and now might be a little bit more in doubt, but if Anthony Davis qualifies for the Rose Rule and then gets 30%. But what's really...
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Maybe he won't qualify if this goes
on. I sarcastically said privately before the season that it would be kind of funny, in a sad way funny, if Lillard got qualified for the Rose Rule and Davis didn't, because we all had it the other way. Like, I mean, my Excel has it, you know, assuming it one way and not the other. And the other thing to think about with New Orleans is this is the first time in a while that they just have their picks, their first-round picks are unencumbered moving forward. So
Yeah, so they can actually reap the benefits.
Yeah, and so this is one of the few ways they can actually realistically make their team better. And so, you know, I'm not sure they're going to be so bad that they can, you know, get in the mix for Scal, though I think he would be the perfect fit.
If they could just get one guy on a rookie contract who actually would contribute to this team going forward, that would really be helpful. I mean, AD is still young enough that that'll help. And by the way, for those who don't know the Rose Rule, we've been over this on occasion, but basically if you either win NBA MVP or you are voted in as an all-star starter twice or make an all-NBA team twice in your first 4 years, you are eligible for a contract that's 30% of the salary cap if you sign for a max. If you don't do that, then you're only eligible for 25%. So that would be the difference basically between 5 years about, you know, $125 million or so and 5 years about $150 million or so, maybe more about like $145. I don't have the exact math in front of me, but... So, you know, it saved the Pelicans like $3 million a year, $4 million a year or so off of that. Yeah, basically about $4 million a year. The starting salary would be about $21 million instead of $25 million on this new contract.
How dirty would it be if people like around the league try to encourage fans to vote for Davis as the starter just to, even if he's hurt, just to get, because I think it's being voted in as the starter. It's not about actually playing in the game.
Right, that's true. And that might be part of it. Yeah, Kyrie Irving actually, by not qualifying last year, probably saved Tan Gilbert like $15 million in salary and luxury taxes over the course of his contract, maybe even a little bit more than that, but that's just eyeballing it. All right, we got anything else?
No, I think that's about it.
All right, anything to plug? Yeah, I think you do have something to plug, your KD piece, which has been kicking ass in terms of like page views.
It has been doing well. So basically, I wasn't trying to make any value judgments in terms of what should or will happen, but I wrote if Kevin Durant decided to go to the Warriors, how it could look. And basically the key part of it is that they could keep their core together and get him in using cap space. So you don't even have to use the kind of cheap out of using a sign and trade, which is a possibility. But, and again, I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying that people need to be thinking a little bit more broadly about 2016 because there are more teams in the mix than some are thinking.
This is something that we'll get to many other times, but I'll tell you what, if Golden State wins the championship this year, I don't know that I would want to do it, even if he wanted to come there. That would be something to think about. I mean, I think you probably would just because you're set up with so many good players for so long. But I think they would most likely, if he came, I mean, you're messing with a lot of good things. If they continue at a historic pace and win the championship again this year, and now you're going to mess with that team, I don't know. It's but yeah, we'll have plenty of time to get into that. I also have something to plug. I wrote a far less successful piece at the Cauldron today about, it's also on my Facebook page. You can check it out there. It's linked on some of the adjustments that I've seen from coaches so far this year. Very nerdy strategy piece with a bunch of GIFs and stuff. So it talks about ways that teams are combating ice defense, some of the ways that they're using dummy drives to set up action elsewhere, and a few other things as well. So that's if you're a real dork, you can read my piece. If you're only kind of a dork, then you can read Danny's piece. Maybe that's how we'll break it down.
Or you can just read both.
Explain how. all right. So if you would like to support the program, obviously there is that cap space code from our sponsor SeatGeek. That's a great way to do it. Also an iTunes review or rating. I say this every time, but I mean it every time. That's really helpful for us. And also people have wrote some wonderful things on there that have really made us feel good about this project and keeping it going. And also, you know, the higher we are on the rankings, the more we can get some sponsors on, which also helps. And then you could also check out my Facebook page, Nate Duncan NBA, Danny's Facebook page at Danny LaRue NBA, or follow us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA, and Danny is Danny LaRue. All right, that's enough plugging. We will talk to you all next time.